the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Just 3 weeks ago before the California primary, and while you might think it's going to be easy, there are a few new wrinkles you need to know about voting in L.A. County. Plus, Donald Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner's rise to the White House has been a long time in the making, even further back than you might guess, as in before they were both born. It's all coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Ian Martinez. Glad to have you along with us today. All right, coming up, Joshua Tree is in an uproar over new regulations for rental properties, and the stakes are high.
If these rental operators cash out on their business, they say it's not worth it, I can't afford these fixes, well, then that could drive down property values and crater the local economy.
Plus, we kick off a special report examining the bottom rung of the housing market. It's called Stuck, Inside California's Housing Crisis. That's coming up in about 10 minutes. But we start with politics. The New Hampshire primary is tonight, and California is just 3 weeks away. Last week's Iowa caucus meltdown has ratcheted up the stakes for our primary March 3rd. And in Los Angeles County, voters will be navigating a gauntlet of changes to how they cast their ballots. KPCC's Libby Denkman has been following it all and has this report on what could be a perfect storm for election administrators here in L.A.
In a brightly lit basketball gym at Salazar Park in East L.A., Mercedes Serrano is test driving one of L.A. County's new ballot marking machines.
It's pretty awesome. It's like everything there on the screen. It was really easy to read and easy to follow.
The devices look like cheery yellow booths with tablet computers in the middle, nestled between headphones and large tactile buttons. First, a county election worker dials up Serrano's information on a new digital electronic poll book.
Now I'm going to prepare your ballot.
Serrano's ballot is printed out, she inserts it into a slot, makes her selections on a touchscreen, and finally...
It lets you review it at the end on screen, and then it prints it out for you again. Once you're done, then you insert it back into the machine, and you're done.
This brand new technology is just one of a heap of changes Los Angeles voters are facing this primary season. And these changes are adding up to worries about how confusion could impact participation in a hotly contested presidential election year. Here's another big change. This election, most Angelenos won't go to their usual polling places. Instead, they'll cast ballots at all new vote centers that will open up to 10 days before the election. The county only announced where the centers would be late last month, just weeks before the primary. It's a massive shift for millions of L.A. voters who've historically voted more in person than by mail. Many candidates are worried that come Election Day, voters will show up to an empty church or school gym where they usually vote and won't know where to go.
That's what's keeping me up at night.
Republican Mike Garcia is running for Congress in North L.A. County. He says his campaign isn't just spending time winning over voters' support. They also have to explain the ropes of the new system.
The primary itself is now 3 months earlier, right? So it's a six-lane Memorial Highway dedicated to confusion.
This all began with an ambitious goal, to create the first publicly owned voting system in the country, accessible to everyone, no matter their language or disability barriers. The new ballot marking devices were developed over the past 10 years, the brainchild of LA County Registrar Dean Logan, who showed off the system at the mock election last fall.
We are excited. It's great to see so many people coming out to get a look at this.
Logan says there was no product like this available on the market, so LA had to create its own. From scratch. He emphasizes the system has gone through multiple rounds of testing, including this mock election. And despite the high-tech interface, the fundamentals are the same.
It is still a voter-marked paper ballot. This device is not retaining your voter choices. It's not tabulating your votes. It's actually just allowing you to mark the ballot in a way that's clear. But for tabulation, the printed ballot is the official ballot.
But not everyone is confident in the new technology. In January, Beverly Hills filed a lawsuit over how candidates' names show up on the digital ballots, arguing the interface makes it too easy for voters to accidentally skip ahead and miss choices. Last month, the state certified the new voting system.
I think this is a huge milestone, not just for Los Angeles County, but for democracy.
But while singing its praises, Secretary of State Alex Padilla also added a stack of conditions the county must meet before voters start to use the new machines. That includes smoothing out paper jams that could slow down and frustrate voters, and tightening security flaws that popped up in testing, like adding tamper-proof seals on physical ballot boxes, improving password handling and disk encryption, plus better training election workers to handle problems. Padilla also insisted voters be given the option to hand mark paper ballots when vote centers open February 22nd.
For anybody who chooses not to take advantage of the innovative ballot marking device.
Kim Alexander, president of the California Voter Foundation, says she's hoping for the best because the stakes are high. LA County is the largest voting jurisdiction in the country, so
those problems take on a much bigger scale.
Alexander says the new expanded in-person voting period could take some pressure off delays or glitches involved with the new voting equipment. That's if voters know where to go.
We need to be encouraging people to vote early, not to wait until the last minute.
Registrar Recorder Logan says his office has worked to fix problems and has invested in outreach to inform voters. He's confident the new system will improve elections in Los Angeles. Covering politics, I'm Libby Denkman.
And Libby is here with us now. She's joined by Brianna Lee, Associate Editor of Audience Engagement for KPCC and LAist. And these two will join us each week leading up to the March 3rd primary to fill us in on all the important things voters need to know before they cast a ballot. Libby, Brianna, thanks for joining us.
Hey. Hi.
So Libby, one of the biggest concerns outlined in your piece is that because of these changes, voters might not know where to vote. So what are officials doing to make sure that people know where to go?
Sure. In order to use all this new high-tech equipment, of course, folks need to know when they don't have a neighborhood polling place anymore, where to go now. LA Register Recorder Dean Logan got back to me about the outreach campaign that they've been conducting. It's both advertising and in-person events. They've been holding numerous town halls. They've invested in billboards you might have seen around town, multi-language transit ads, English and Spanish TV commercials, radio commercials, all kinds of social media. The list goes on, but we won't know how effective all of this has been, of course, until in-person voting starts later this month. Los Angeles is also sending out more mail-in ballots than ever before. In the past, that number's hovered under 50%. It's really lagged behind the rest of the state. But the registrar is estimating over 60% of Angelenos will vote by mail this year, which is a big jump. But the worries are out there, that folks don't know that this is happening. Yeah. Congresswoman Maxine Waters issued a statement this week saying that even though she has held multiple town halls on the voting changes, she is concerned that the message isn't getting out to communities in her district.
Brianna, you're fielding a lot of listener questions about the election coming up. Have you heard from people asking where they should vote or how to find out where to go?
You know, surprisingly, we haven't received very many questions at all about the voting centers, and that in itself is a little bit worrisome. I think by and large, people just don't really know that anything has changed. It's really just easy to assume that if you've been voting at the same location for every election, that you'll just go back to the same place again this year. But, you know, for a lot of people, that's not going to be the case. But we have received maybe two or three questions about it. Some people just want to know where the closest voting center to them is. One person asked whether they can vote in a different city from where they live. And by the way, the answer to that is yes, you can vote in any voting center in the county. But one person actually wrote into us because they were looking at the Secretary of State's website to find out where their voting center was. And it was telling them to go to some random residential location in their neighborhood. And then they clicked on a different link and it gave them another completely different voting location. Yeah, so it was really confusing. And Libby actually ended up calling the Secretary of State to flag this issue. And they just wrote back to us this week to tell us that the problem was fixed.
So Libby, it just sounds
like... Impact right there.
Yeah, people are still a little kind of confused about stuff.
Yeah, and I think that things are still shaking out. It's interesting. I've been talking to the candidates as I've been out on the trail reporting on important races. And early on, I would go speak to city council or congressional candidates, and they wouldn't themselves be aware of the voting changes.
Oh, no.
But now that things have kicked into high gear, campaigns are very worried that their voters will get left behind. So as you heard, the congressional candidate that I spoke to in the 25th district, they're investing resources not just in winning over people's votes, but also in just talking about the mechanics of voting, which is an extra step.
Now, I know people are concerned about all this, but this has been implemented in other counties with some success. Libby, what does that tell us about how this will go in LA County when it comes to voter turnout?
Yes, the vote centers are a result of this 2016 law called the Voters' Choice Act that has been implemented before in 5 counties, including Napa and Sacramento. And that was in 2018 that the system rolled out there. Turnout did go up in those counties 3-4%, but it's really hard to make a direct comparison between those 5 counties and Los Angeles. LA is just so massive, 5.5 million voters, very diverse, and it's historically dealt with lower turnout compared to most of those other counties. It's also a presidential election year this year, not a midterm. And really the biggest difference, A, is that in Los Angeles, the county had a one-time carve-out in the Voters' Choice Act that they didn't have to mail ballots to everyone. So mail-in ballots didn't go out to everyone like they did in those other counties. And so the question is, with LA focusing on the in-person experience, will there be an issue with folks knowing their vote centers and knowing where to go?
And let me just to remind people, if you like to vote in person, you can do it early and you don't have to wait until March 3rd.
Yeah, that's definitely a big thing that elections officials are trying to emphasize. Vote early, go into a vote center when they start opening on February 22nd. A few hundred of them will be opening, and Brianna has a great collection of how to find your local vote centers online at laist.com. That will really take the pressure off. The changes that you're going to encounter when you walk into a vote center, finding where you vote now because your neighborhood polling place is likely going away, all of that will be a little bit lower stakes because you have more days ahead of the election. You can take your time, take care of any issues. Like if you're a no party preference voter, you can request the correct ballot. Perhaps you want to register same day or change your party registration. All of that, there's plenty of time to address it. We have all that info again online. And A, if you really want to vote early, you can go right after this show if you want to go down to the county registrar's office in Norwalk.
I'm going to take my time. Norwalk's far.
It is a little bit far for most people to go, but February 22nd is when those centers start to open.
Now, turning briefly to ballot itself, we all know about the presidential candidates, but there are a number of other important races that people should be aware of and actually educated on before they cast a vote. So, Libby, remind us about some of those.
Okay, buckle up here, because there's a lot. One of the closest watched races is the future of the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. Of course, we've talked about that race on this show before. That's incumbent Jackie Lacey with two challengers, public defender Rachel Rossi and the former San Francisco DA George Gascon. It's a race that's getting so much national attention, and you're starting to see TV ads being run by these candidates and PACs supporting them. That's because this is the latest round in a wave of efforts to get progressive prosecutors elected across the country. It's going to affect things like charging, sentencing, bail reform, all of that stuff. So you're going to see a ton of advertising on that race, which is likely to go to a runoff in November. Voters in LA are also deciding on the fate of 7 Los Angeles City Council seats, 3 spots on the LA County Board of Supervisors, and that includes the 2nd district that represents most of South LA, at least the western part of South LA, Inglewood, Culver City. That is pitting Herb Wesson, the former city council president, against State Senator Holly Mitchell and former Councilwoman Jan Perry. That is a very contested supervisor's race. The most competitive city council race is between John Lee and Lorraine Lundquist in the 12th district, parts of Porter Ranch, San Fernando Valley. That's a rematch you'll remember from the August 2019 special election.
I do remember that.
It seems like only yesterday, right? John Lee has only been on the council since then. And of course, this one is going to be very competitive with it being a presidential election year and not a special election. When you look at Orange County, you have all of those congressional seats that were flipped to the blue column in 2018.
Right. Yeah.
Republicans are going to be trying to win those back, in addition to Katie Hill's seat in North LA County. Races on your ballot, of course, are going to vary with where you live. A few of the ones that I think will trip people up are the local measures. That includes Measure FD, which is a parcel tax on unincorporated land in Los Angeles County, and that's to fund the fire department in the county, which says it's increasingly being stretched thin because of the wildfires that are becoming very devastating in our area.
Measure FD for fire department.
That's Measure FD for fire department, exactly. And Measure R, which may confuse some folks, that would grant a civilian commission that oversees the sheriff department more power, like subpoena power for documents. There's also changes involved with Measure R in planning for jails and diversion, alternatives to incarceration. And statewide, finally, because these measures are often confusing, Proposition 13. It's not the famous property tax proposition in order to,
Were about to panic a little bit.
Yeah, there was going to be some fisticuffs here because that is going to be a huge question, whether or not to split off Proposition 13 from commercial property and residential property. That's going to be a decision in November. But right now we have Proposition 13, which is a statewide $15 billion school construction bond. So those are just a taste.
Wow.
I mean, we're dealing with superior court judges, all kinds of races here on your ballot, So, we're going to bring you as much information as possible, and it's all online at the Voter Game Plan.
All right, let's wrap up with a special feature of this segment, the question of the week. And Brianna, as I mentioned, you're going to be fielding a lot of questions from listeners about this whole process. So what is the key question people want to know?
So quite a few people have been writing in to ask us, where is my sample ballot? That's the little booklet that tells you all the candidates and the measures that are going to be on your ballot this year. So people usually get it in the mail, and people have been wondering, why haven't I received mine in the mail yet? How can I view it if I want to see everything that's on my ballot? So both the LA and Orange County registrars sent them out in the mail a couple of weeks ago. So they should have arrived by now. It's really up to the post office. But if you haven't received yours yet, you can see your sample ballot online at the county registrar's website. For LA, that's lavote.net. For Orange County, it's ocvote.com. If you really, really want a hard copy, you can contact the county registrar and just ask them to resend it to you. But interestingly, there's one of the new features in LA this year is the interactive sample ballot. If you go to the LA County Registrar's website, you can view your ballot and make your selections right there on the page. And you can actually save it, and it'll generate a QR code. It's called a poll pass that you actually bring with you to the voting center when you go to vote in person. Then you just scan it in, and it'll populate your voting choices on the machine, and you just review it and turn it in.
You can get a lot more information and get your voting questions answered if you head to the Voter Game Plan. It's online at laist.com. That's laist.com. My thanks to Libby Denkman, KPCC's politics reporter, and KPCC engagement editor Brianna Lee. Libby, Brianna, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Thank you.
All right, now to a special report we'll be running all week with a focus on the bottom rung of the housing market, the rentals of last resort, and the landlords who own them. We're calling the special Stuck, Inside California's Housing Crisis. To start us off, KPCC's Aaron Mendelson takes a look at unsafe and unsanitary living conditions.
The River Glen apartment complex in San Bernardino sits between an empty lot and a sports bar. There isn't a river or a glen. It's more than 100 units, three brownish buildings. A man tosses furniture into a dumpster. He says it belonged to someone evicted a few days ago. Nearby, a woman named Shay stands under a carport.
I'm stuck here.
She calls life here chaos.
I mean, this is the ghetto. This is nothing but the ghetto. It's like have you guys seen New Jack City? That's this way. They don't try nothing to stop it.
Safety is a big concern here. After a shooting in 2018 injured eight people, the management company said it would add security guards 24/7, but I'm here for hours and never see them. Up on the second story of one of River Glen's buildings, we meet another tenant, Nancy Romero. She shares a two-bedroom with her three kids, her roommate, her roommate's baby, and a lot of bed bugs.
At nighttime, you know, when they're coming out, like I grab them and I put them like in a little jar and I have them in a jar. So, yeah.
Do you have that jar?
Yeah.
Can I see it?
Yeah. These are the ones that I just, you know, that I run into. The other ones I've been killing and stuff. You see, all those are bed bugs.
They're reddish brown and dead. They slide around the bottom of the jar. Romero keeps the bed bugs to show the managers. She and her three kids have bites all over their arms. She's embarrassed to send her kids to school like that. She worries someone might call Child Protective Services.
So I had to throw on my couch because it was full of bugs, you know. You know, and matter of fact, it was my roommate that noticed it's something, you know, getting me, you know. And we have the newborn right there, and she's like, you know what? Let's look, you know. And it was like full of bugs, like little white, little baby tiny like maggots and stuff, you know. But we spray every night. We spray, you know. We get Raid. We get the alcohol, that whatever, not. We'd be spraying everything every night.
Like her neighbor Shay, Romero says she's got no other choice.
We low-income people, we don't have the money to just say, come on, let's pick up and go. Yeah. You know, we don't want to live like this. Let's go. If you don't got nowhere else to go and you need to move in somewhere, you don't want your kids to be homeless, you know?
Other neighbors complain of mold, of cockroaches. This building is well known around town. The city actually fined the owners $50,000. But code enforcement inspectors keep finding the same problems. Tenants say the management company is slow to fix problems and quick to evict. Gary Blasey is a retired professor from UCLA School of Law.
There's so much tension on getting people into any kind of housing that nobody's paying much attention to what kind of housing they're going to be able to get into.
He says people are forced to live in places that are unsanitary, even dangerous. And officials, even when they know conditions are poor, their hands are tied.
The health department almost never shuts a building down.
The housing crisis is so bad, Blasey says, if you do shut a building down, people could wind up on the street. Many tenants have nowhere else to go. Blasey says low-income tenants don't have the political power to change their situation or the means to get out of a dirty or dangerous rental. In other words, they're stuck. I'm Aaron Mendelson.
Tomorrow on Take Two, a story about the life for the landlord that runs the building, and you can hear more of Aaron's reporting for Stuck in an hour-long special that'll air Thursday at 2. And if you have questions about what you've heard about low-income housing and regulation in California, you can call us at 626-583-5281. That's 626-583-5281. Leave your question on our voicemail and your name as well, and we'll try to answer it later this week. All right, Donald Trump's rise to the White House has been a long time in the making, even going back further than you might guess. He's been a television personality and a celebrity businessman, but this story goes back before he was even born. It's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Andrew Bernstein co-hosts the WNYC ProPublica podcast Trump Inc. We last spoke in May of 2017. That was 4 months into the Trump administration. At the time, she was reporting a story about an LA-based real estate and development company called the CIM Group, which had been doing business with the president and his son-in-law and top advisor, Jared Kushner, for years.
The problem is that you can have a company like CIM and everything can look fine, but the laws and regulations that we have in the federal government were not written for this situation, that the situation is unprecedented.
In the time Trump and Kushner have spent in the White House, they've tried to distance themselves from such partnerships, but have they completely divested? Well, the line between distancing and divesting can sometimes be tough to see, especially when families build wealth by plugging into politics. Now, that's the case Andrea Bernstein makes in her new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. The book starts with the story of the Kushner family, with Jared Kushner's grandparents in northeast Poland in the 1930s.
Not long after that, the Nazis came in.
Soon, Nazis had rounded up thousands of Jews and told them,
you go to the left, you go to the right. One side was to live, one side was to die.
The family of Jared Kushner's grandmother was put in line to board trucks.
And they were going to be taken off to trenches on the edge of town where thousands of Jews were going to be shot that day and fall into their own graves.
But as the line to the truck begins to move, a Nazi approaches and says,
is there anybody here who is a furrier? Because they needed fur coats and hats for their push into Moscow. Jared Kushner's great-grandfather was a furrier, so they pulled him out of the line. They pulled the whole family out of the line, and they survived.
They would go on to escape from the Nazis, hiding out in the forest and eventually making their way to a refugee camp in Italy where they would stay for 4 years, struggling to immigrate.
But then they hit on this idea. Jared Kushner's grandfather was born Yussel Berkowitz. And they hit on the idea that if he presents himself as his father-in-law's son,
they will have an easier time immigrating as a family unit. So that's what they do. Yossel Berkowitz becomes Joe Kushner. They get visas. They immigrate to New York with $2 in their pocket. Yossel Berkowitz, Joe Kushner, is a carpenter. And he becomes a builder in New Jersey at this time in America where there's such a demand for housing and so much federal support. And from being a Holocaust survivor, having lost everything, he and his wife, Ray, build a business worth many millions of dollars by the time Joe Kushner dies in the 1980s.
That leads us to Jared's father, Charles Kushner.
So Charles Kushner is one of the sons of Joe and Ray Kushner. Jared Kushner's father. And Charlie Kushner was a very public guy and began to get very interested in politics and gave all kinds of money and all kinds of donations to Democrats in New Jersey because he saw that as a way of enhancing his stature and his business. And he started to do things that you're not allowed to do.
Yeah, it got him into trouble.
Make donations in the names of other people, evade taxes. So his older brother Murray sues him, and they're not making the case go away. So he hires a police captain to enlist the services of a sex worker to entrap his sister Esther's husband, Billy, gets a videotape of the encounter, hangs on to it for a while. But when he realizes that the case against him is not going away, he sends it to his sister on the eve of her son's engagement party. And he's arrested, Charlie Kushner, Jared Kushner's father, for witness tampering, campaign fraud, and tax fraud. And ultimately pleads guilty and serves prison time for that.
Now, it seems as if the Trump and the Kushner family businesses were the whole time on parallel paths, bound to intersect someday, using similar game plans along the way. Tell us about some of the things, like finance laws, that benefited each family.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that's interesting to me about these two families is that they both were aggressive players in the games of political influence. So real estate is a huge industry in New York. And everybody who is a real estate developer understands that in order to get a business edge, you need to cultivate political ties because political figures have the ability to approve if you want to build a higher building than is allowed or to get a tax break. So Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump, figured out very early on that he needed to play this game, and he played it in a big way. He gave, and Donald Trump followed suit. Donald Trump gave so much money in political contributions that on several occasions, these contributions caught the attention of regulators. You know, we look at the way he handles his presidency and the way he sort of invites transaction. He invites people to behave exactly the way he behaved as a businessman. The Kushners also, Charlie Kushner was a politically connected developer on the rise, and he was about to get one of the most powerful non-elected positions in New York and New Jersey, which is the chair of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which owns bridges and it owns tunnels and it owns the airports. And it is a huge bi-state agency with a budget larger than many, many states in the United States of America. So he was about to get named chairman of this post at the time his brother Murray sued him. His finances began to be scrutinized, and he had to withdraw from that.
Which led to Jared taking over Kushner Companies.
Right. I mean, Jared at a very young age. So he is in graduate school. He's in law school and business school when his father is arrested. And he hadn't intended to take over the business, but he stepped in and began playing a bigger and bigger role and eventually became CEO of the company while he was in his 20s. He signed the mortgage documents for a $1.8 billion building, which was at the time the most expensive real estate transaction in Manhattan for an office building.
Talking to Andrea Bernstein, her book is called American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trump, and The Marriage of Money and Power. Let's get to the marriage part of the whole thing. Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, October 25th, 2009, at the Trump National Golf Club in New Jersey. It's where you start the book, a ceremony in front of 500 guests, which, as you wrote, quote, included people who had regulated or could regulate the Kushner and Trump family business. Businesses had offered or could offer tax abatements or zoning relief, who could, in theory, investigate the family business if they ever ran afoul afoul of the law. So, Andrea, who was there?
A lot of people that are known to many people were there. Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, was there. Two governors were there. The attorney general of New York was there. The police commissioner of New York City was there. The speaker of the New York State Assembly and the New York City Council were there. For Donald Trump, it was a distinct moment of saying, here is my power. By my getting you to come to me, I am showing you that you are part of my world. And when I call on you, I expect you to be there.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I want you to read a part of your book, Kushner Trump Wedding. We just heard the star power and the political muscle that was there. But read to us how you summed up the event in your book.
So this is from the end of the prologue. That night, as guests left clutching their giveaway prayer books and a pair of Havaiana flip-flops that said Jared on one and Ivanka on the other, laced through with a string calling them a great pair, they were forced to embrace Trump's ostentatiousness, even as they participated in his display, to pay tribute to this marriage of money and power, to acknowledge the authority of the patriarchs. From the vantage point of everything they had built, the families could say, "We've arrived. You are complicit in our power. We are a force to be reckoned with. Pay respect to us." Foolishly, the world did not.
Andrea, what examples are there of this merger, this marriage, this merger working to benefit each other?
Trump, at this point, couldn't get any U.S. bank financing because he'd so badly burned banks in Atlantic City. And Jared Kushner helped connect Trump with a foreign bank, Deutsche Bank, to help him get financing for golf courses and his hotel in Washington, D.C. And in turn, Trump helped out Jared Kushner when his $1.8 billion skyscraper almost failed. So there was a sort of trading and enhancing of each other, but in a more sinister way.
And then during the Trump campaign, Kushner is a trusted advisor to Donald Trump. And then we see he become an advisor for Trump while he's in the White House. So there is a little bit of the you
help
me.
He's one of the most powerful people in this White House. He's survived so many. I mean, it's like I can't even name all the people he's survived. Reince Priebus, Steve Bannon, Jim Kelly, Jim Mattis, H.R. McMaster, Mike Flynn, John Bolton. The list just goes on and on.
One last thing on this, because I have to ask, what makes the Kushner-Trump clan any different than, say, past politically fused business families like the Kennedys or the Rockefellers or the Bushes?
I mean, America has always had an oligarchy, and there have always been these vastly rich political dynasties. What's different with these two families is they do not see a distinction between their personal interests and their family interests and the national interests. That is the explicit policy of the Trump administration. We heard his lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, argue that if something was going to help his campaign, it was a fine thing to do. In court, they've argued the president has absolute immunity from even being investigated. So what's different is they've broken down all these walls. There's not even a sense of shame or pretense that there's a separation between the personal and political.
Andrew Bernstein's book is American Oligarchs, the Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, I know it's only February, but spring break will be on us before you know it. And Joshua Tree is a very popular destination to spend a week or a weekend. Lots of really cool houses to rent. Well, for now at least. You see, San Bernardino County has been cracking down on building and safety codes, which could leave Joshua Tree's short-term rental market short of rentals. Find out why when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, lots of news all afternoon long here on KPCC, and Nick Roman is the host of All Things Considered. Nick, what do you got coming up today?
Well, the two-week coronavirus quarantine is over for the 195 State Department employees and relatives who'd flown into China from China, that is, to March Air Reserve Base near Riverside a couple weeks ago. We have a story coming from KPCC's Robert Garova. Also, this afternoon, LA County supervisors are looking to revamp the lead office in the battle against homelessness locally. And Carolyn Champlin will have that story. And we will bring you NPR's coverage of the New Hampshire primary. That starts at 5 o'clock. We'll have results and analysis from NPR's political reporters, plus reaction from the candidates. All of it starts at 4 o'clock with All Things Considered after Marketplace at 3 and The Frame at 3:30.
Now, Nick, earlier today, we were both on Air Talk with Larry Mantle talking about a possible new playoff format for Major League Baseball coming up in a couple of years if it indeed happens. What would happen is that a team, the second best division winning team in baseball, would get to choose their opponent, their playoff opponent. You've had a few hours now. Are you accepting it as much as I am excited over it?
No, it's nuts.
Oh,
it's completely nuts. It is, you know, I can see guys, you know, passing bribes, and it's just going to be, it'll be a mess.
I can't wait till that reality show when it all gets revealed. Nick, thanks a lot. Talk to you later.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. For the uber hip, vacationing in the desolate desert 2 hours east of Los Angeles is the place to be.
I can't believe you've never been to Joshua Tree before.
I know.
Oh my God, we should go to the Integratron and get a sound bath. Yeah, it's like so healing and regrounding. It's really incredible.
And just like in the film Ingrid Goes West, hipsters find the Joshua Tree is the perfect place to meditate and Instagram under the stars. But that tranquility has been broken by regulators. A wave of Airbnb units and other vacation rentals have spread across the sands like tumbleweed. Now, while they're an important part of the economy for locals, new rules for those properties are now in effect in the town of Joshua Tree, and they have been upsetting some hosts. Louis Sahagan reports on this for the LA Times. Louis, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now set the scene for us. How many short-term rentals are in the area?
The number of short-term rentals has exploded by 21% over the last year to an estimated 1,160 unlicensed vacation rental businesses. They range from single-family homes to trailers, Sherpa huts, teepees. In fact, there are even patches of concrete on which to pitch a tent or park a vehicle that locals call, say, are rented by slab lords.
Haven't heard that one. Yeah. So, Lewis, how much does this kind of tourism drive the local economy?
It's a major component of the local economy, which is why people are so nervous. This is a place where it was pretty hard to find a job for many decades, where the median annual income is about $37,000 compared to $60,000 a year in the rest of San Bernardino County. So it's a low-income community, and now folks have found a way to create a lucrative, you know, revenue stream. So they don't want to lose that.
Yeah, and you mentioned people are getting nervous. Last December, a new law went into effect to regulate these rentals. On a basic level, what are the rules?
Now, people are facing up to code enforcement, which they've never experienced. And that goes for virtually everything from floor space, like square footage per person sleeping in a room, to, you know, hot tub requirements, to recessed lighting, water heaters, roofs. And people are worried that they will not be able to afford to come into compliance. Again, this is an area where there were no rules whatsoever, and there were no lodging taxes. So people were building anything without fear of punishment for decades.
Talking to Louis Sahagan, reporting for the LA Times on new regulations in Joshua Tree. Now, once the law was in effect, officials went out to inspect units in full force. Louis, can you describe some of the examples of what they would do and what they would be looking for?
Under the law, in order to continue operating a short-term rental, you have to be in compliance. You need an inspection. They're looking at electrical installations. They're looking at ceiling fans. They're looking at hot tub installation. They're looking at whether, you know, the roof was installed properly. So these inspections run the gamut. That was a shock. For some reason, Joshua Tree residents, and I'm not sure why this is, but many of them told me, we knew this was coming one day, but we thought, we were led to believe that they were only going to be looking at health and safety requirements such as smoke detectors or how high off the floor a fire extinguisher is.
Okay.
Instead, they're looking at every single possible permitted item.
But why are property owners upset over this kind of inspection?
Because somehow they feel they were led to believe that they wouldn't be under this kind of scrutiny. They thought they were going to be dinged for easy fixes like smoke detectors in order to keep operating. So suddenly they're faced with having to, you know, spend a good chunk of change to come into compliance with this new ordinance. So they may not be able to do that anymore. If they don't, there is now a new concern that if these rental operators cash out on their business, they say, it's not worth it, I can't afford these fixes, well, then that could drive down property values and crater the local economy, which is now reliant on this kind of business.
How have officials in Joshua Tree responded to some of these concerns?
Well, there aren't officials in Joshua Tree. The officials are in the county headquarters in San Bernardino. So the locals, they're banding together and fighting back by filing complaints, for example, with the county. The complaints usually include that inspectors came and they were heavy-handed or unnecessarily invasive. But they are also taking notes, sharing notes about their inspection experiences and looking for errors that were made during the inspections by official code enforcement officers. And if they gather enough mistakes, they believe, then they can go back to the county and say, look, these code enforcement officers, we told you they were being heavy-handed. Look at all the mistakes they're making. And if they can do that, they believe it will force the county to relax its inspections.
In terms of citations, any idea how many have been issued? And is there a legitimate concern about these units being misused?
That's an interesting question because I told you there are 1,160 unlicensed vacation rental businesses, and they now require a permit. They have a deadline of March 31st by which to file an application for a permit to get the inspection and continue operating. Of the 1,160 to date, only 90 have filed an application. So that's a lackluster response.
Wow.
But many people are waiting to see if, under pressure to do so, the county will relax its inspections.
You mentioned March 31st. In April, a lot of people have spring break. A lot of college kids, a lot of high school kids, parents want to go out to Joshua Tree. I'm wondering what impact does this tension have on the people who might want to head out to Joshua Tree to rent for the weekend in the next few months?
That's an interesting point. I'm not sure that the people who want to go out there are aware that this is going on. The impact rather will be perhaps if there are fewer places to go to, or maybe there was, you know, a rental that they were repeat customers at that may not exist. But in a year or two from now, when the new ordinance really chips away at the number of rentals, that's when you'll see an impact on visitors, on customers, because there won't be as many left.
Any chance, Lewis, that this could be a blip as locals adjust to a new normal? Because I'm wondering, this regulation probably isn't going anywhere, but does it really have the power to upend the vacation rental market there?
Absolutely, it does. County inspectors are beginning with this compliance campaign with single-family residences that were turned into short-term rentals. When they're done, then they are going to turn to the alternative forms of lodging, the teepees, the huts, etc. And when they do turn to those operations, They're going to be looking at things like, is your sanitation system up to code in a teepee? And a lot of those are expected then to be ordered to be shut down. But many of those alternatives were low investment business operations. So it's not like tearing down a house, for example. You could knock down a teepee and throw it in the back of a truck and leave town. But it will have a huge impact.
Louisa Hagen is a reporter for the LA Times. Louis, thanks a lot.
Absolutely.
But when you think of me, I hope you think of Joshua Tree that summer where the road went on forever.
All right, once when I stayed at a really fancy hotel, I took a couple of towels home. Now, before you judge me, if you'd have felt how soft and fluffy those towels were, you'd have done the same thing. And I know that because LA diners have stolen all kinds of stuff from restaurants. Steak knives, light bulbs. It's so bad that one iconic eatery even had someone banned. Find out which one when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Restaurants all over Los Angeles are reporting thefts of everything from forks to glassware to even light bulbs. And the managers are fingering their patrons. After a meal or a couple of drinks, people are just walking off and out of these eateries with a little souvenir of sorts. And they just didn't pay for it. Haley Eber wrote all about the phenomenon for LA Magazine, and she's here now to tell us all about it. Haley, welcome.
Hi.
All right. So what first tipped you off that this might be a story worth reporting? Apparently a crime spree. Restaurants all over L.A.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, I think we know that people swipe the occasional mug here and there. But several months back, I was having drinks at Mini Bar, and they have these great coasters with celebrities carved into them to match celebrity different booze brands. And they were kind of talking to me about how people had swiped them and how they kind of tracked down different customers and figured it out and kind of got me thinking, you know, there's some fun stories behind some of these thefts from restaurants and bars.
See, and that one to me isn't that bad. I mean, if we're going to be judging the morality of some of these thefts, it's a coaster. It feels very disposable.
Right. I mean, they are kind of custom-made coasters, but it's a coaster. You know, if you grab one and not the whole set, it doesn't seem like too big a deal. But definitely some of the other items were a little bit shocking what people were taking.
All right, let's get into some of those because copper mugs. People are actually stealing copper mugs.
Yeah, the classic mugs that they serve the Moscow Mule cocktails and are kind of a big thing to swipe, you know, and I don't think it's not the biggest crime. You know, people have a few drinks and take shiny things.
Is that part of the excuse here is that maybe they're drinking alcohol and they're not in their right mind and I wouldn't do this if I wasn't maybe tipsy or drunk?
I think so for some of them, though. It was interesting. We have a tiki glasses that were taken from Ronin in West Hollywood, and they were telling me incidents where people kind of come in with a party of four and have a whole game plan as to how they're going to get four matching glasses. Glasses, you know, together. And that, you know, I think that's quite premeditated. So,
yeah, copper mugs and then, yeah, tiki glass. And they're long, too. I mean, so they're not as easy, maybe, to take as a copper
and
mug.
And they're breakable. So you've got to plan what you're going to get it out of there in, I guess.
Yeah. Now, okay. Now, there's something else on the list here. And we're going to keep going through some more of these things. But this one, I tried in my mind, Haley, to picture it. Light bulbs?
That one, yeah, I think that was the most shocking one to me. And I mean, not only are you stealing something, but it seems quite dangerous to be, you know, sitting there at a bar and unscrewing a light bulb as the lights are turned on. But I guess, you know, some people are really attracted to these kind of vintage looking light bulbs at employees only bar and they're willing to swipe them.
Yeah, that's in West Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I can't imagine how that gets set up. It's easy to take a mug and stuff
right.
it in your bag or a tiki glass, but I mean, don't you need some coordination to steal
a light? Yeah, and to, you know, reach over a sconce or, you know, it's quite an endeavor. So that one was quite surprising to me.
Now, tiles, that also gets stolen?
The tiles were actually, they're used more like a trivet. So they'd be, you know, set beneath a hot pan on a table or something like that. They're quite large, so it's a little bit quite obvious when they come to remove a large hot pan and there's nothing underneath it anymore.
See, to me, that one, Haley, you got to be thinking about that one way ahead of time.
Yeah.
Because who goes into a restaurant? You're going to there to eat or the environment. And you're thinking about, I want that tile.
Yeah, who goes in and thinks, oh, I'm going to get this. You know, there are probably almost 6 inches by 6 inches. It's a heavy thing, but you really have to, you know, think, oh, I was there last week and those are cool. Who knows?
P. People are taking stuff from restaurants. Haley Eber wrote all about it for Los Angeles Magazine. All right, let's get into some more of these items. Brass animals. Where is that happening?
So that's at Moza, and Nancy Silverton collects all these kind of little brass figurines. And I don't think, you know, they're all that expensive, but they have quite a high sentimental value to the restaurant. Every night before service, they arrange them in a special way in the bar, and they have names and such. So, you know, I think that's one of those things that seems not a huge item to steal, but the restaurant is quite upset when people take them. And they've gone as far as to review security footage when one has gone missing and banned someone from the restaurant for life.
Banned someone from Moza.
Yeah. And it was just a no questions. We saw you security footage. You took our little animal and you are out.
Because in some of the other places we've talked about, they just charge the people.
Some of them they just charge. And even one of the restaurants, APL Steakhouse in Hollywood, they caught someone who had snuck. They have these beautiful, very expensive hand-forged steak knives, and they'd snuck one out in a baby carriage of all things. And the restaurant reviewed the security footage, tracked them down, and, you know, they returned it, were very apologetic. And I guess they're good friends and regular customers now with the chefs.
So. Yeah, steak knives, though. I mean, so typically these steak knives in these high-end places, how much do they run?
I mean, they can go anywhere, you know, maybe $50 on up. These, because they're hand-forged, and I think, you know, the chef makes them himself, they've set the value very precisely, and it's written on the menu at $950.01, such that it is considered a felony. It just gets...
Wow.
So, you know, they can really go up, up, up.
Wow. So the motivation for someone to do these things, is it just because they want to get away with something? Is it just because they just want something from the restaurant to take home with them other than the meal that's in their tummies? Why do this?
I mean, I think, you know, it's a couple things. I think yet another thing we can kind of blame on Instagram, but I think we're all a little bit more design conscious. And so there's cooler things out there to steal. I think the main thing is people don't think they're going to get caught. You're not sitting at a booth at a nice restaurant thinking that there's surveillance cameras on you, but often there is. And so it kind of often seems like a quick, easy swipe and a victimless crime, but it's not, you know, especially some of these smaller restaurants where they're losing $2,000 worth of glasses in a year, which is the case at Ronan with the tiki glasses.
All right, Haley, moment of truth here. Have you ever taken anything? You're laughing already. I don't even need to finish the question, from a restaurant.
You know, I was trying to think of this. I've definitely swiped, you know, a pen or two from when I've paid the check, and you know, I don't think I'm entirely innocent, but I can't remember every boozy night in my 20s either.
Well, is it a Mont Blanc pen or something like that? Or maybe...
No, I mean, they were not fabulous pens, so I don't feel that guilty. But I'm sure I don't think I'm entirely innocent.
Haley Eber writes for Los Angeles Magazine. Haley, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
If I were to ever get banned from Moza, I might as well just leave LA. I might as well move. Life here would not be worth living. All right. You can find us all over Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well. At A. Martinez. Now, I got a poll up there about how honest you are about stealing stuff from restaurants. So make sure you take a look at it. That's also good for Twitter and Instagram, A. Martinez LA. Take Two's back tomorrow, too. Talk to you then.